we began to understand that they are both a type of myopia. Your short-term thinking kicks in when you think, I don't want to change because I want to stick to my roots, or I do want to change everything because I want to make my mark. The long-term thinkers, the folks that we really started to pay attention to after this, were those people who said, we need to hold on to some of this, but we need to evolve these other parts. And I think part of why that's difficult is it takes a lot of time and diligence to look at what your business offers, or what it's offered in the past, or how it might be evolving towards the future.
That was today's guest, Lucas Connolly, and he's the executive editor of the Legacy Lab, an organization that helps companies to build long-lasting brands. In this episode, Lucas talks to us about the various ways people and companies can help build something long-lasting in a constantly shifting digitized world, how different companies have gone about building their foundations, and why legacy building is something that everybody can embody. But before we start, I want to welcome you all to Digital Mindfulness. On this show, we bring together experts from around the world who focus on discovering and creating time well spent digital experiences. Over the last 4 years, we've brought together global thought leaders to discuss the latest thinking on topics such as digital wellness, ethical computing, digital detoxing, mindful technologies, information overload, children and technology, and much, much more. To find out more about us and to join our growing international community, go to digitalmindfulness.net, where you'll find some required listening podcasts and links to our upcoming international events. Okay, let's get on with the show. I hope you enjoy listening to Lucas Connolly. Lucas, thanks so much for joining me here on Digital Mindfulness. It's a real pleasure to have you on, and I'm really excited that we're going to be talking about your new book release. So welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on.
So, Lucas, let's start from the beginning. And, you know, this is a question I ask all of my guests, but I wonder if you just give a little bit of background to yourself and particularly how you came to really be writing about this fascinating topic.
Sure. Well, I started my career in journalism. I was an intern at the Atlantic Monthly right out of college. And what I loved about that magazine was that they would devote a lot of space to long, interesting stories. And in an age of the internet where we're seeing shorter and shorter time devoted to telling stories, they were kind of going against the grain. They were swimming upstream. And as my career unfolded in journalism, I went on to write a book called Obsessive Branding Disorder. I worked at Fast Company magazine for years. And I always craved that kind of environment where you could really take the time to tell a story from the people's perspective, from the business perspective, to get to the human side of things. And what I was finding increasingly was that most media outlets were looking for shorter and shorter stories, more quick tips, more listicles. So when I got a call from one of my longtime collaborators, Mark Miller, to come work at his organization called the Legacy Lab, I jumped. It was an opportunity to really look at brands and how they build legacies over generations, not just for overnight success or instant gratification, but really generation after generation of evolution in a world that's really thinking more about minute by minute.
That's great, Lucas. So I wonder now if we can turn our attention to the topic of attention that you cover so thoroughly in the book. And in particular, I wonder if you can talk about how the conflict really arises when people in general, when we need to plan for the long term, particularly when we're talking about our digitized lives, planning for the long term in terms of our lives. How does that conflict when, I guess, everything that we experience digitally is really set up to reward short-termism?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the things we noticed, Mark and I, as we set out to research the book, and this was really before we knew we were going to write a book. It was more about understanding how people built legacy in the modern age. Was we started to see something what we came to call the short-term thinker's blind spot. In the marketing world and in the world of brand building or business building, you would see this as folks who either see the past as something they have to hold on to so tightly that they don't want to change anything for risk of failure. You don't want to rock the boat. It's a very difficult market for brands to grow and to scale. We just want to stick to what always worked. Nobody wants to be the guy who changes the recipe for Coca-Cola. Then we'd see another type. These folks who want to change everything. They'd say, we did this way in the past. It's not relevant anymore. Consumers want something different. I want something different. Executives these days have such a short timeline in the C-suite that they want to make their mark. And a lot of these executives make their mark by changing everything, just jumping into dramatic change. And from the consumer perspective, the downside there is, of course, you know, you see radical change and you don't know what to expect from brands that you're accustomed to. So they're two polar opposites. But when we looked at them long enough, and it took us a while to kind of to drill down on this, we began to understand that they're both a type of myopia. Your short-term thinking kicks in when you think, I don't want to change because I want to stick to my roots, or I do want to change everything because I want to make my mark. The long-term thinkers, the folks that we really started to pay attention to after this, were those people who said, we need to hold on to some of this, but we need to evolve these other parts. And I think part of why that's difficult is it takes a lot of time and diligence to look at what your business offers or what it's offered in the past or how it might be evolving towards the future, and just to kind of filter out what is relevant and what is still woven into culture and what needs to go or what needs to be put on hold for a while. And that I think plays a lot to attention, because we do pay a lot of attention to the new shiny thing. And that's, I think, part or half of that short-term thinker's blind spot that we notice.
Lucas, I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit more about the Legacy Lab and what that is exactly, because having read the book, it seems to me that the Legacy Lab really is a physical manifestation of the ideas that you are presenting in the book.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Legacy Lab was founded in 2012 by Mark Miller. He's the chief strategy officer of an advertising agency, branding agency, a media agency called Team One out in Los Angeles, California. I've collaborated with Mark for over 10 years now, and really beginning when I wrote my first book back in, I think, 2006 or 2007 was when I first started collaborating with Mark. So the Legacy Lab began out of a desire to address that short-term thinker's blind spot, a desire to say, how can we study brands that do evolve and do adapt without leaving their roots behind and without reinventing themselves entirely? How can we look at what we began to call modern legacy? And we would distinguish modern legacy from a traditional idea of legacy at the Legacy Lab, because what we would find is people are pretty hung up on the idea of legacy as something in the past. When you talk about legacy, people think about something that's either, it's a longstanding tradition, it's always been done this way, it's handed down from generation to generation without change, and you have to respect the past. That's a valid idea of legacy, but we were talking about something much different. We were looking for those people who would bring their legacy to life every day and build upon it moving towards the future with an idea that this is something that's alive and thriving and vital. And so that was the birth of the Legacy Lab, was this desire to look at legacy in a new way and a desire to learn more about how really modern legacy builders operate. You know, what are they doing? How are they changing the world in ways that we can learn and share with others?
My next question to you really was going to be, which brands or which companies are doing this particularly well. But I think a more important question to really have you answer is what legacy is exactly. Because I think whilst we all think we know what legacy is, it's not something that we think about on a day-to-day basis, except when major life transformations happen to us. So I think it would be really helpful if you can just describe to us exactly what you mean when you talk about legacy.
It's a great question. I do think there are two definitions for us especially. There's the traditional way of looking at legacy, where you might see somebody who builds their fortune in one area, and then at the end of their life says, oh, wow, I've got to leave a legacy, and suddenly starts ramping up their thoughts of the future and how they want to be remembered after they're gone. And then there's another set of folks who say, I'm working to change the world in a certain way, and I want to bring it to life with others who rally to my cause, who inspire people around the world to do something differently or bring a change about in an unconventional way, and then that it will persist year after year and stay alive and vital. And that is what we come to call modern legacy. So we're not talking, when we talk about modern legacy, we're not talking about something that you put on a statue, on a pedestal in the square and look at for generations to come as something that never changes. You know, we're talking about a very living thing when we talk about modern legacy.
You know, I'm really fascinated by this idea of legacy, particularly as it relates to the digital sphere, because when you traditionally think of legacy, it's something that is permanent. It's something that's inscribed in stone. So you would see it in things like, I don't know, the Sistine Chapel or in the great literary works. But when you take that idea then and ascribe it to the digitized world, it becomes incredibly ephemeral very, very quickly. So you're talking about just general people, and you know, I'm thinking about social media, people posting their lives to social, or you have something incredibly important that you want to share with the world. That post, it's almost like content eating itself, that phrase, content eating itself. So that post is gone in seconds, and the attention that people pay to that shortens by the day. So I'm really interested, how then does that idea of legacy, how does that play out online, and how can you really achieve it in the traditional sense online?
Yes, it's a great question, because it really applied to my life in journalism as well. Beginning at a very time-honored institution like the Atlantic Monthly that had a print version for I can't even remember, we're going back into the 1800s. And you would print something with your name on it, and people would hold that in their hands, and then they would put it on a shelf, and then it would be there forever. And I watched journalism take the arc that you've just described, where it moved online and then it got shorter. And now we read an article, and maybe we can go back to the link, but ultimately things are very ephemeral. We move through material very quickly, whether it be journalism or so many other areas of our lives online with content. And brands are living that ecosystem as well. And I think that perpetuates that problem of legacy versus modern legacy, right? You have this sense of, well, this worked in the past, so I want to stick to that because people remember that. They know that, you know, this is our color and this is our motto and this is where you can find us and these are the services we offer. And then you have folks who say, no one's paying attention to us, and we want to change everything to get attention again, because attention has become this, you know, very difficult, ephemeral, slippery quality. So what we do in the book is we look at the leaders who have actually managed to build legacies that are vital and alive, that are drawing more people to them, that are inspiring new generations of consumers and are evolving. And we set out five steps that I believe respond to your question. I think these five principles, these five guidelines, help modern legacy builders understand concepts that are maybe beyond the ephemera of the internet. And just quickly, I'll tell you, they're, you know, have a long-term personal ambition. This is something that you desire to change about the world or to achieve, and you've got a long-term vision of how it might go or what it might take. Follow a certain set of beliefs and behaviors. This is for the people that rally around you. You know, what are our values? How do we bring them to life? Not just talking about them, but actually the deeds that we do to bring them to life. What kind of influence can we generate with this? Not just the people that work for us in the beliefs and behaviors that we follow, but the consumers that listen to us. You know, how can we get them engaged? How can we get them to help tell the story? The fourth step is, what are we doing differently from everybody else? How is it unconventional? Otherwise, someone will just copy us, and you know, there we are once again, kind of in the ephemera world. And the final step is the perpetual step. A lot of innovation, a lot of change comes in bursts. And in the past, traditionally, that was how companies innovated, in a kind of episodic manner, when innovations were available or needed. And in the modern era, it's building a legacy is a perpetual day in, day out practice type of behavior. And that's, I think, in response to also the idea of keeping attention, that perpetual nature keeps you out front and keeps you vital and keeps you relevant.
Okay, gosh, there's a lot there. So I think it's going to be really helpful then for us to go through exactly what each of these five steps are. But beginning with ambition, again, I think ambition is a term that's a little bit slippery, like legacy. So it would be really helpful if you can just talk to us again about the different ways that really impressive brands are using and cultivating this ambition to do their work. Because going back to the metaphor of this content-saturated world, I think we're told every single time we pick up our phones that it's important to have ambition and to use that to fulfill our professional or personal goals. So tell us how ambition is cultivated and how it's being used particularly well.
Yeah, absolutely. So the chapter itself walks through three different lessons that we see that help discuss personal ambition, long-term personal ambition. But the story I'll give you right off the top of my head, which I love, is the story of Yvon Chouinard at Patagonia. And that this kind of captures a lot of the long-term personal ambition thread. So all of the leaders in our book are drawing their long-term personal ambitions, just like the word says, personally. They're drawing it from something in their lives that is real to them. So we may all have an ambition to make a lot of money, but that's not necessarily personal. There's if everybody wants to make $1 million, and so that's not very original. You're competing with everybody. But if you draw your long-term ambition from something personal, you have a much better chance of it being incredibly unique, something that no one else is going to do the way that you would do it. Yvon Chouinard at Patagonia, back in the 50s and 60s, was a climber. Here's a guy who's now, the leader of one of the world's largest, most respected outdoor gear brands, and is regularly in the news for a variety of different reasons. But they've built an incredibly respected brand on the principle of leaving no trace. When he was a climber, the climbing tools that were available to him were tools that you hammered into the side of a mountain as you climbed and you left behind you. And so the attitude at the time was, let's conquer this mountain. I will essentially claim that route and everybody will know that I was there, or everybody will remember me because I took that route and I was the first to do it. And anybody that comes along can either use my tools that I left behind or will have to hammer in their own. And so the result was these beautiful climbing routes that he would want to climb were slowly filling up with junk. So he decided to try and invent a tool that you could remove, a climbing python that you could hammer in. And then as you kept going up the mountain, could then pull out, remove, and reuse essentially recyclable climbing gear. He went on from there, and the success that he built off that, to reinvent other climbing tools and to move into clothing and start to see clothing as tools that left no trace. They built this incredible brand out of his one long-term personal ambition that was real to him. And today, in a year where the brand actually devoted its homepage to standing up to the current president of the United States, saying, hey, the president stole your land. We're fighting for public land in America. And, Patagonia took a stand. A lot of people said this might be a really bad move for them, but it was their most profitable year yet. They drove more revenue, more profit this past year than any before. And I think that all of that comes from a place of, people resonate when you have something personal to you. They really attach and engage and want to assist when they can feel that it's not just you trying to make $1 million. It's you trying to accomplish something in your life that's real to you.
It's interesting because, the title of the first chapter really is this whole idea of taking leadership personally. And I do love how the chapter is structured, and I'd love it if you can just talk about this a little bit more. But the whole idea that if people are thinking about, right, how do I create this living legacy? How do I kind of create this? How do I become a better leader in this age? This whole idea of contribution before extraction, I thought was interesting. And I guess that would speak very strongly to the Patagonia example. that you just mentioned.
Yeah. Contribution Before Extraction is a great one. That's the story about Tribeca Film Festival. And briefly, what happened there is after the September 11th attacks, the founders, which included the film star Robert De Niro, were all residents of Tribeca. They were looking at the devastation in the neighborhood, looking for a way to bring the neighborhood back. And because of their love and background in film, they said, what if we were to hold a film festival here in the neighborhood? And that would draw people from the outside. It would draw people back into the restaurants. It would draw people to spend money in the area and really revitalize what was a suffering neighborhood. And the funny thing about that is it began even just as a group of downtown dinners. They wanted to get people back into the neighborhood. So that was the goal. That was the ambition. And as it took shape as a film festival, it really flourished. And now, you know, many years later, it continues to bring new life into that neighborhood. So that it really started with a contribution. It started with an idea of how to make the world better. What problem can I solve? How can I change a situation that I see as unjust? And then grew out into something that's very successful today.
Of course, it always happens that even if you do have ambition and you do have a clear strategy, you're always going to come up against problems, obstacles that you need to navigate around. And the section in the book where you talk about Girls Who Code as an example of an organization that navigated successfully those challenges, I wonder if you can just talk about that a little bit, because again, these challenges are something that I think everyone can attest to.
Yeah. So this section is about finding opportunity in obstacles. And Reshma Saujani was trying to be a politician. She actually ran for office in New York and failed in the primary. She made a good run, but she lost in the primary in a statewide election. And during her campaigning, one thing she looked back on when after her loss was all the schools that she'd gone to. She spoke to, you know, public schools around the state. Was that when she would talk to people in who wanted to be in tech, who wanted to be coders in the computer labs, she would only see men. She would only see boys. She would only see teen guys. And she thought back as she was kind of licking her wounds and figuring out what to do next. That's something that I could address. If I can't be a politician, I might be able to have more impact on the ground by trying to find a way to get more women into tech. She spent the next year building a program, getting it set up, and then launched as Girls Who Code. And what they do is that they provide opportunities for girls to learn how to code around the country. And I think they're expanding now maybe to other countries besides the U.S., they've been very successful in recent years. Tens of thousands of girls have been trained and placed in internships with tech companies, you know, all over the world. And one of the things she's able to do is to engender the help of major tech companies who recognize there's a gender imbalance in their industry and that it can't keep up. It's something that ultimately leads to cultural issues for brands when they have a very bro culture. So being able to draw more women into tech is not just great for the women who are able to learn the industry and have jobs. It's great for the balance of an industry that needs a more well-rounded culture. So she's had a tremendous run of success. And really it roots back to this idea of looking at your life and saying, you know, not what's the easiest route, what's the shortcut to the $1 million, but where's the obstacle that no one else has been able to solve? You know, where's the mountain that no one has been able to climb? And you know, how can I forge a path to a new solution? I think that when you look at modern legacy builders, so often they were able to solve something that no one else was able to solve because of that long-term personal ambition that they were able to identify the obstacle in the first place.
I'm interested to know as well, I guess from your own experience of like having delved really deeply into this subject matter, are the things that you're writing about now, are these things that you've kind of embodied yourself? Like, for example, this whole idea of following your beliefs or behaving your beliefs. Like, are you now, having spoken to all of these, you know, amazing companies, are you starting to do that now yourself?
Absolutely.
Building your legacy?
Yeah. I think that is the beauty of what we're doing at the Legacy Lab, is that we're not just, when I was a journalist, you'd go out and you'd learn something, you'd write about it and you'd share it with the world, and then you'd talk about it with readers. And then you'd go out and talk about something else, but it might be something entirely different. You know, maybe the general theme for me might have been literary or business or sports, but the next story could have nothing to do in specifics with the previous story. With this organization, with the Legacy Lab, the work allows us to build on what we're learning, and not just for ourselves, but then to share what we're building with readers, with other companies. We are also consultancy, so we do help brands wrestle with issues and draw from their past to build their future. But the work that we're doing, it really feeds itself and grows, because we learn as we study these brands. We learn for our own lives, for the brands that we're consulting down the road, and for future books. Obviously, we continue to learn, and we continue to put lessons together for what may be a second book in the near future.
You know, having spent so long in this subject matter, who would you say, either what company or what person would you say really impressed you in terms of the people who are building this living legacy?
Boy, it's so hard, because not only do we have the 22 brands that we talk about in the book, but we have so many more that we've spoken to, that we publish online, that aren't yet published online, that we've spoken to, that we're still in the process of editing and putting together. One example that I would point to that I really love, that might drive some of these lessons home, is Taylor Guitars out here in California. They appear in the fifth chapter, and one of the things we focus on is their ability to transcend generations. And the way that they do that, they've done that, that really I found inspiring, is that these two founders, who built this brand, for several decades now, into a worldwide respected guitar brand, have, rather than as they approach retirement looking to sell the brand to the next, the highest bidder, to another guitar brand that may repeat what they've done in the past or build the same guitars, they went out and they started searching for the person that would behave like them, the person that would build guitars like they did when they were just two guys repairing guitars in a guitar shop when they were young. And the guy they found is a guy named Andy Powers, who's in his 30s, who believes in innovation, who believes in ethical sourcing of wood, who believes in the things that they believe, and is someone who's going to carry those same values, those beliefs, forward to the next generation. Very, very often what happens with a brand that's successful is someone else buys it and they don't have the same long-term personal ambition. And as consumers, we recognize that almost immediately. We start to see the things that we care about slip away, or we start to see that it becomes just words. But rarely, very rarely do you see a brand who says, we're consciously going to take a choice to take the time to find somebody who will believe like we believe, and pass the brand on to that person. And that's what Taylor Guitars has done.
This is a very quick divergence from my notes here, but this is a question that's just come up for me. And I wonder, Lucas, if the people that are creating this living legacy, as you just described, whether these are people who would be parents, or they're pillars in the community, or they're people who are taking responsibility in the workplace. But these are people who are unintentionally leaders in whatever sphere it happens to be, that these are people who would be creating that living legacy.
It's a great question, right? Because it is taking leadership personally is this first chapter. And one way I think I can get at what you're asking about is the last point in the chapter, of each of the chapters, we provide something we call the Legacy Builder's Balance Sheet. And it's essentially a tool or a kind of a qualitative way of wrapping your arms around something that otherwise would be kind of a soft topic or a soft idea, and trying to measure it. In the case of the first chapter, we look to a concept called Ikigai. Have you ever heard of this concept?
I personally have, but it'd be great if you can explain it for the audience.
Yeah, so Ikigai is a wonderful concept. I really love this concept. There are even now other books about Ikigai out there. But to apply it to the business world, I think really gets at what you were talking about parenting, about being a leader. Ikigai is a Japanese concept from Okinawa. And I think it's kind of timeless. I don't even know if there's an understanding of how old this concept is. It's been passed down so long. But the idea is that there are four ways to zero in on what is your long-term personal ambition. What is your right place in this world, or the most satisfying place for your life? And those four things are to do what you love, to do what the world needs more of, to do what you're good at, and to do what you can get paid for. And so often, I think when you talk to parents, they struggle with this concept of like, well, I want to tell my child to do what they love, but in the current world and in the real world, so that can often mean, you know, that the child may never do something that they get paid for, or that the world needs, or that they're any good at. So there's kind of a realism to this concept of Ikigai, that if you can zero in on those four things, doing what you love, doing what you're good at, doing what you can get paid for, and doing what the world really needs more of, if you can find something in the middle of those four, you have essentially a bullseye for your life, not only for success in the traditional sense, but success in a personal satisfactory sense of feeling fulfilled. So I think that gets to this idea of like teaching others towards leadership, or setting an example, or trying to counsel others towards how to be. That I think the Japanese had that concept down with Ikigai.
That was fascinating. So I wonder now, with the last couple of questions that we have, if you can give brands some real concrete advice on how they would go about creating a modern legacy. And in particular, it's very obvious that brands would be thinking about this all the time. But for brands that maybe are thinking about this in a slightly different way, insofar as they want to get, I don't know, a billion followers, or they want to have so many views, how can brands really start thinking about creating this modern legacy in the context in which you're describing?
It's definitely a holistic process. So that five-step process that we walk through, or the guidelines, they're kind of a loose toolkit, more likely in our book. So it really starts by identifying, and it may already be there, by identifying your long-term personal ambition as a brand. And often this comes from the founder, but we also have refounders, people who've come into brands and said, you know, I'm going to bring to life the aspects of the brand that are truest to the current context, to myself, to our consumers. So starting with that long-term personal ambition is the key. That's the foundation, because everything else doesn't play out without that. Then identifying what are the values, right? What are the beliefs and behaviors that we rally around to build from? If we're going to build this modern legacy, we have to believe as a group that in alike, we can't have a different set of values and not follow them, or they can't change day to day. Because consumers will notice, employees will notice, and that affects everything from recruiting to, you know, really to sales. So once you have those first two steps, it's about being influential. And I think in the modern era, this is particularly relevant to the digital context. I mean, how do we engage consumers in a way that makes them want to help us tell the story? And the brands that are able to do that are wildly successful. We don't resent them for it, because there's a sense that they're bettering our lives. We get a sense of belonging. You know, it's not just clicking a like, it's actually passing on by word of mouth. It's sharing, it's evangelizing, it's advocating for these brands. So what is it about your brand that will resonate in the market in a way that will allow consumers to help tell the story and carry it forward? From there, the fourth step is how are you different? How are you unconventional? What are you doing that's not like everybody else in your category? And the story that I love for this is a story about Grey Goose vodka. You know, here's a story about a couple guys who one of them came out of the cognac industry, one of them came out of traditional spirits, and they said, we can create a ultra expensive, ultra premium vodka made in France with artisanal techniques. And at the time, that was very unconventional. Nowadays, vodkas have become very sophisticated. But 20 years ago, this is 1996, the idea of a vodka that was at the top end of the market by cost twice as much as anything else out there, and was made in France with these very artisanal approaches, was unconventional, to say the least. But when you look at modern legacy building, so often these brands are able to say, we're going to do something very unusual. And then in retrospect, it looks inevitable. Like they really do open up markets and they create what we like to call a category of one. So after you've got the long-term personal ambition, the beliefs and behaviors, and the influential ideas lined up, there's a question you can ask yourself about how can we be a category of one? How can we be not competing with others in our category, but be in our own? And then the final step, which is in some ways the easiest to think about, but the hardest to do, is, and now how can we do all of that every day? You know, how can we bring these things to life through practice? You know, how can we establish the rigor to continue doing this and not let it slide off as we grow?
It's great because I really love the end points you were making there, because certainly these are things that should be followed. But my next question, and I think you probably know what it's going to be, is how then can we apply those same principles to people? And, you know, again, when we talk about leaders, people might, you know, I definitely don't want the audience to think that we're just talking about CEOs or people that are heads of department. Actually, how do we, you know, we're all in charge of whoever we are in our lives online. We're all in charge of how other people perceive us and how we interact with each other. So how can we apply that same legacy building, long-term legacy building framework to our own lives, would you say?
No, I love that question, because when we sat down to write the conclusion to this book, Mark and I realized that all of these stories, you know, we set out to tell these brand stories, but what we really had done is we had told personal stories. You know, all of these stories exist because there are people behind them, and all of these principles apply to people. They apply to people who are trying to build their own brand. They apply to students who aspire to someday build a brand. They apply to people who are assuming a new role in a company and want to be a leader. One of the things that I think is most resonant about the book is that in juxtaposing it against traditional legacy, you know, the sense of this modern vital legacy, what we realized was that there was an antecedent to each of these principles, that the way traditional legacy was built in the past, to give you a comparison, wasn't long-term personal ambition. It was following organizational principles and institutional principles, you know, the way that IBM was built, or the way, you know, that some even modern day companies still operate in a very organizational, institutional way, where there are rules to follow and a hierarchy, and you know how you can get where you want to get because that's all been established before you. But each of these chapters is built on a contrasting principle from the past. And I think that when leaders, when listeners too, when people come to this book, I think they will see that there are ways of doing things in the past that will be familiar to them. And if they're drawn to build a legacy in their own life, I think these principles will resonate with them.
So Lucas, tell us where we can find the book, and tell us also how people can get in touch with you and connect with you once they've read it.
Absolutely. They're welcome to reach out to us at thelegacylab.com. That's our site. We're based out in Los Angeles, but we're regularly touring the country either for the book or for clients. So we're always happy to meet up and speak to people about the principles in the book, or about what their brand is going through, or what their goals for their brand are. You can find the book at, of course, at all the traditional retail outlets, and Amazon and Barnes and Nobles and others. We're always happy to reach out and share more about the lessons in the book. And we're always looking for the next generation of legacy builders. One of the two things that we're doing right now that are pretty exciting are reaching out and actually helping fund modern legacy builders of the next generation. That you can learn more about that project online, the next generation of legacy builders. And we're actively looking for ways to bring this brand to life ourselves, just like our principles discussed, we're trying to apply them, you know, to the Legacy Lab itself.
Well, Lucas, thanks so much for spending time with us today. I really appreciated all of your insights, and wishing you the very best of luck with the book.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.